So
there was a I guess they were a publisher called Gathering of Developers, where they were kind of a loosely banded together group of independent game developers. And yeah, they would rent the parking lot across the street. Yeah, and it was they had
I remember
schoolgirl outfits.
I remember this year you're on the right track. I got on the bus. I can't remember which company I was at the time, but we had just finished up. It was the last day of the show. We get on the bus and we're right across the street from the parking lot that you're talking about. And they've got RVs or Airstreams or whatever out in the parking lot. And there's something being played on a projector screen on a brick wall of a building. And I'm looking at it going, that looks an awful lot like some softcore porn thing that you'd watch on, late night Cinemax or whatever. And it literally was.
And girls, this is out dressed, in the open.
This is out this in is the open LA. In downtown LA. And this is coming from a video game publisher lot. There's girls dressed in schoolgirl outfits. There's little people coming in the room. And it's like, oh my God, what the fuck is going on with this industry?
Welcome to the D3 podcast, Drunk Developer Diaries. We're drinking at the bar, so grab a beer and pull up a stool and listen in as we talk to video game professionals to hear all their stories about how video games are made, how you might be able to get into the industry should you be so inclined, and hopefully hear some of their stories along the way. I'm Ryan Woodland, your host. I'm currently the technical director at ZeniMax Online Studios in Baltimore, Maryland.
And I'm your co-host, Jeremy Morrison. I've been working as a producer and an editor in broadcast television and indie film for over a decade. I'm the founder of Harborcraft Films, a video and film production company whose studio bar we are recording from in beautiful Baltimore, Maryland. And it's raining right now, so you might be able to hear that. We're not in the urinal. The views and opinions expressed on the D3 podcast by its hosts and guests do not represent the opinions of any entity whatsoever with which its guests or host are or now will ever be affiliated with. Specific information and personal details may be omitted from recordings to protect the identity and reputation of those discussed. And with that out of the way, Ryan, who is our guest tonight at the bar?
Tonight at the bar, we have Matt Knowles. Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you very much.
That's for Matt.
So it is Drunk Developer Diaries. Most important question that we always start off with, what are you drinking tonight?
Unfortunately, right now I'm starting with a Miller Lite.
Unfortunately, that's my beer of choice. Come
so on, we need to step this up to, I'm in Baltimore. I need to have a Yuengling. So.
Yeah, that's isn't that from Pennsylvania?
It is, but it's closer than the West Coast. So I'm just going to drink some Yuengling. So
we can make that happen.
Well, we have it in the fridge. Unfortunately, it got a little warm in my Jeep on the way over.
It's all right. I was supporting the local brews, though, with some Loose Cannon before this.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he pre-funked. So,
I did.
Okay, that's a good thing.
Yeah, he got started a little bit earlier. So Matt is actually the marketing director at 2K in the Bay Area. He's out here in beautiful, rainy Baltimore. But you've been in marketing and brand development in video games for quite a long time, about 20 years now, right?
For a very long time, 22 years in the industry, yeah.
All right, so we're going to get into this. I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast want to get into game development, and I think you're about to hear why you need to make very good friends with your marketing representation.
That's right.
We can make the games.
Make good relationships.
He's the one who has to sell them. Let's start the beginning, though. Where are you from? You're from West Coast, right?
Oregon? I am from the West Coast. Originally born in California, grew up in Idaho and Oregon. Oregon was kind of the formative years.
All right.
And then after going to college at University of Oregon, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. And my brother and sister-in-law, both in the industry at the time, and got wind of an open job down at a division of Sony. And I applied for the job, got the interview, and got hired. And that was my start.
So, this is actually our sixth podcast. I don't know about chronologically, but
I think it's, oh, yeah, yeah.
You're the third person we've had on here that has a sibling in video games. So,
yeah.
Your brother John is creative director at Turn 10, right?
Design director
at Turn 10. And he's going to be on the podcast next Monday when we're doing our special E3 editions.
Hey, we haven't even mentioned that we're doing the E3 edition.
Yeah, well, we just decided.
He just surprise. There we go.
So, all right. So you ended up down at Sony, but did you go to school for marketing or
how I did. I actually got a degree in marketing with a concentration in sports marketing.
Oh, that's good.
So it's kind of funny. I've been in the industry for 22 years, connected to companies that make sports games, but never actually worked on any of the sports games. Well, that's actually not true. I worked on a racing game and a soccer game way back when. But
interesting.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you landed at Psygnosis, right?
Yep.
Okay. And what was your first gig? What were you doing?
I started off as a PR coordinator, and it was kind of hilarious because I reported to two different PR managers. One was this straight-laced professional PR woman, and I went in my interview and met both the PR managers, and she shows up and she asked me all the hard questions, and in walks the next PR manager. He's wearing Bermuda shorts, a Hawaiian shirt, he's got tattoos up and down, he's got earrings, and he's Scottish. And I didn't know what to make of this, but he's actually a good friend and actually works with my wife's. Funny enough, but it was a start. PR coordinator, stuff in envelopes, and it was back in the days before email, and back in the days before, you know, little USB drives.
So
every time we had to make a screenshot, it was on a 35 millimeter slide.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's great.
That makes me feel a little. But that was my job.
I hate to break this to you, Matt. We are old.
I know. Hey, but you know, the industry's evolved.
So, did you grow up with games, or I mean, was John being in the industry kind of a catalyst for you to go in there?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. I mean, my brother and I grew up in the arcades, right? We would ride our bikes down from our house down to when we were living in Boise. We'd drive down and park our bikes outside and just dump an unlimited amount of quarters in every possible game, like Tron.
Oh, yeah.
My brother was really good at Dragon's Lair, all those like Twitch games.
Yep.
And we got our start doing that, and then, you know, had an Atari 2600 and had the old Nintendo. And then he ended up getting a job in the industry, and I would just go hang out at his work when I would go visit him. I would sit in his office literally and do nothing but play games while he's, you know, drawing stuff.
Yeah, you started as an artist, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what sort of stuff was Psygnosis working on at that time?
So when I started, when I moved into marketing, which was like 6 months after I started, Wipeout Excel was there, Destruction Derby 2.
Okay, yeah.
A bunch of other games. And that was kind of the first start. I was helping out with those games.
Was this even PS1 era?
PS1 era.
Okay. Yeah.
And then when I got my first gig as a product manager, the first game I worked on as a legit product manager was Spice World, the video game.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
That's awesome.
It was exciting.
Yeah.
And you know what? Up until about 2001, it was the best-selling game I'd ever worked on.
Really?
Can we ask how many units Spice World sold?
I don't even remember. I mean, at the time, it was probably like a half a million, which was a big deal back then.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
What were the dynamics of this game? I just wanted to
know. So it was a rhythm game, like Parappa the Rapper and Busta Groove.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Except it was the Spice Girls.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, we all start somewhere, Matt.
Hey, there's a soundbite for you. You can plug in some Spice World music.
I don't know. We don't have the licensing.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Don't get us in trouble, man. This is a shoestring budget podcast. So, all right, you already mentioned this, and this is a legitimate question. Like, a lot of times I'll ask questions that I kind of know the answer to, but I am thoroughly confused on this. What is the difference between marketing and PR?
I don't interface with the editorial community.
Okay.
So PR is really kind of taking your game, going out and dealing with the likes of, well, at the time, it was all the magazines.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
Now it's everybody with the website. Yeah. It's influencers on YouTube. That's not my realm. My realm is as brand director to develop the global strategy for the games that we're going to do, develop the creative, which ultimately winds up as the box art and all that stuff, working with agencies and whatnot. Or whatnot, and then doing it's direct to consumer as opposed to direct to press, which I guess PR would be.
Oh, interesting. Hey, that helps me. I've always wondered why we have two departments. So how long were you with Psygnosis?
Was there for 2.5 years, and then decided to leave, went to a little company that was based in Hunt Valley.
Okay.
Interact Accessories.
All right. You didn't live here, did you?
No. Yeah. They opened up a West Coast office. They were making peripherals for everything back then. Xbox, Dreamcast, PlayStation. They had the Game Shark.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember the Game Shark.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that lasted about 9 months, and they decided to close the West Coast office.
This is a theme that runs through our podcast. How many times can you get laid off?
Well, I've actually got a pretty good resume. Everything except my current company. Well, no, I take that back. Well, no, actually. Everything that every company I've worked for before is no longer in existence.
Hey, way to shut them down.
That's right. Yeah.
But that's because you leave and they're so...
That's right. I leave a wake of destruction.
Bereft of talent.
I leave a wake of destruction. No, it's just an unfortunate state of, you know, how the industry's gone 20 years.
Yeah.
Psygnosis kind of got swallowed back up by Sony and then closed up shop. Interact decided to close up shop and sell off all their IP to Mad Catz and a bunch of other competitors.
Mad Catz, yeah.
And then when I left there, I went to work at Eidos.
Okay, yeah.
Spent a good portion of my career at Eidos.
So were you working on Tomb Raider stuff there?
I did work on a few Tomb Raider games.
Okay.
I walked in, the very first game I worked on was Thief 2.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I worked Looking Glass out in Boston.
Okay.
And then worked on Tomb Raider... I can't even remember which one I did. I got Dreamcast version of Last Revelation and then Chronicles and then a little bit of The Angel of Darkness.
Oh.
And then, ended up leaving Eidos and went to Konami and then back to Eidos and long story. But
that was Konami Bay Area, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I've actually touched a lot of really cool properties and IP between those two companies. Worked on Castlevania for a bit, worked on Hitman. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. How long were you there?
The first stint was 4.5 years.
Okay.
And then I left. and then went to Konami for 3 years and then went back to Eidos. There's some hidden stories in there, but probably not worth it.
probably. We'll tell them at the bar without microphones.
Exactly. All told, I think I spent 7 years at Eidos between two different periods of time.
Okay. Yeah. And did that take you up to where you are now? Okay. So actually, it's funny. We mentioned you have a brother in the industry, and he met his wife in the industry, right?
He did.
And you also met your wife in the industry back in the Psygnosis days.
Back in the Psygnosis days.
Tell us about how that was. You're all over the game.
So, I'll try and make a super long story short because that covers off about 12 years. But, Psygnosis was an English headquartered company in Liverpool. And we had an office in Foster City, and my day-to-day job when I was a marketing coordinator was get on the phone with the people in the UK and find out what was going on because they were the home office. Mm-hmm. And every day I would talk to this girl who really sounded cute on the phone, but then you never know what that really translates to, right? Because this is in the days before Facebook and email, and you have no idea what a person looks like. Exactly.
Yeah.
So fast forward a few months to E3 in Atlanta in 97, and I meet my wife. Well, I meet this girl at the time, and instantly both attracted to each other. And fast forward another 12 years, we see each other at E3 every year, flirt like crazy. Nothing ever happens. And she comes out to the Bay Area in 2009 and asks if I want to meet up with her. I'm like, yeah, because I've always been attracted to you, and I'm single, and apparently you're single. So sure, let's do it. And we go out to dinner with her friends. We go back to the bar by ourselves, and all these stories start to come up from our time in Psygnosis and every year at E3. And this one story in particular, which makes me feel like such a dork by telling it. But
hey, we make video games. Right? We're all dorks.
We're at the Sony party in 2001 or 2003. It was one of those years. I went with my brother. I met my now wife there, and we started chatting in the bar, and she's like, it's really loud in here. Can we go outside? I'm like, yeah, let's go talk. And we start talking, and unbeknownst to me, she tries to make a move while I'm not paying attention. And apparently, I look down at my watch trying to figure out because I haven't seen my brother in a while. And she tells me the story when we're together in 2009. She's like, I leaned in to kiss you and you looked at your fucking watch.
But you totally missed it.
I totally missed it. I didn't even see it because I was too busy looking at my
Of course, she didn't know that. She thought you were just like chickening out or ignoring her, right?
She thought I had zero interest in her. And I was just totally oblivious. Man, I felt like such a dick.
Well, you got a second chance.
I did get a second chance and I did not blow it that night. We had our first kiss and 5 months later, we were engaged, and a few months later, we were married, and we've been married for 9 years.
So. I love this story. Yeah. It's very sweet. Yeah.
So I haven't seen you in so long. On the ride over here, I was going to ask you, like, oh, it's been like, what, 1-2 years now since you've been married? It's been almost 10 years.
Yeah.
time flies.
Next year will be 10 years officially.
And then you were saying you guys got married, and then 2 days later, you started at 2K.
Yeah.
So it's some honeymoon.
Yeah, well, we paid for our wedding ourselves, so there was not going to be a honeymoon for a while. So went straight to work to pay for the wedding. And then, yeah, like, I don't remember what it was. It was like 8 months later, 9 months later, we did our honeymoon. So we made good.
All right. Now, I want to launch into some of the marketing stuff because I do have questions here. Because I think I'm a developer, obviously. I make the games here in marketing. You promote and sell the games. And from the developer point of view, the opinion is we do all the hard work and you guys get to do all the cool stuff.
You do all the hard work. You guys don't see is the marketing team actually does a lot of hard work.
I'm goading you into
trying
to defend yourself.
No, but a good marketing team and a good development team are in sync. Like the people that know the game best are not the guys that sit in the publishing office and try and come up with a marketing campaign.
Well, so how does that work? Because I know I've worked at places where, like, literally you do just kind of make the game and then kick it over the wall to marketing. Do you actually, you're involved with the teams from kind of inception all the way through development?
Yep. And it hasn't always been that way. It varies company to company, but now I have a really good relationship with the studio that I work with, and I'm there. It's getting further and further out now where we're getting visibility into pre-production and being able to talk about what their vision is for a game and, you know, get the wheels kind of in motion about how could this translate into a campaign. Then you get a bit further and further along and you earn the trust of the studio and they feel like they're involved in and vested in the marketing of the game if the marketing team actually can help communicate their vision.
Yeah.
But my job is to make that vision appeal to a larger audience. So it's trying to figure out how you take game X and make it appeal to audience X and a little bit of a larger audience as well.
So, I mean, what are you looking for early on in production? Are you just looking at gameplay concepts and
gameplay concepts? You know, if it's a character-based game, what do the characters look like? What new things is it offering to the genre or to the marketplace as a whole? And then just looking for little nuggets of things that you can pull away and try and, you know, figure out through the briefing process to an agency how you bring that vision to life. So you're not just putting a game character on a box. You want to make it cool and relevant at the same time.
Now, do you actually get involved with feature work? Like I know on games I've worked on, the marketing will come in and they'll want, you know, certain things at certain times. They'll want to do an event, you know, based around this or you know, they want things that you could sell in an in-game store or whatever. What sort of feedback do you give to a game team? Do you advance your own agenda through development?
I never go in with an agenda. I like to think I don't go into an agenda. It's really getting an understanding of what we're working with and then figuring out how we can take that and elevate it. So there's obviously a production schedule, so you can't go to the development team and say, I need a game demo here, knowing that, you know, they're still making the game. Because you lose credibility with the team.
They do that to me all the time, man.
I know. Hey, well, you can talk to your marketing guy.
Yeah, geez. All right, maybe I need to work with you.
But for
the record, my current marketing team is excellent.
There you go. I mean, it really depends product to product. You know, we're trying to look for things that we can kind of glean off of them and ways that we can piggyback on their milestone schedule and say, okay, we know the game's going to be in this state at this point, and it may or may not be after we've announced a game, maybe closer into launch. And then if there's an event that makes sense and part of the overall strategy, then we'll take advantage of that and then utilize the team to help do that. But yeah, I mean, it just depends game to game, really.
And how many games are you usually working on? Do you just work on one game at a time? So you're managing multiple projects?
I've been known as the juggler for a number of years.
Really?
Yeah. When I worked at IDOS, I was juggling six titles at a time. Oof. When I started at 2K, I was doing four titles at a time. Now it's our teams are not siloed, but put in little business units. So like I work with Developer X, the other brand manager works with Developer Y, and there might be some other projects along the way, and there might be some other projects in the life cycle, but at least you're locked in to that studio and the teams that work at that studio, and it's a little bit easier to manage multiple projects. I also have a brand manager that works for me now, so he does a lot of the heavy lifting.
What is a brand manager? I mean, how does that differ from PR and marketing? Like,
so kind of varies company to company, but you have a product manager and a brand manager. Product manager really is, here's your product, put it in a box, develop the campaign. Tends to be more territory focused, like deal with North American sales, North American media, and deal with the campaign. The brand manager and the way we're kind of set up with our teams now is we're trying to drive the global strategy, provide all the tools and assets to all the individual territories to go off and do what they need to do in their market because they know the market better than we do. Like, I don't know how to sell a game in Germany.
Right, right.
But as long as the German team is locked in with what we're doing from creative side of things, we give them the tools and they go be a success in Germany.
So do you ever drive the products that you guys make? I mean, do you ever sit and say, hey, the market is, it needs a product like this. We need a, you know, first person shooter to compete with this and, you know, in 2021, or are you involved at that level at all?
That's done at a level higher than my pay grade.
Yes, mine as well.
I mean, we talk to the developers all the time. You know, we usually get brought into a project after something's already been signed and already in pre-production.
Okay.
But I talk to those guys all the time. I'm friends all over the place in different roles and responsibilities, whether it be at the studio or at the publishing office. And we often will talk about, like, you know, we do this really well. What if we did this? But it's just kind of on the opportunity.
So, and how do you interface with sales? Because this is another thing. There's this whole sales team. And do they forecast how the game is going to sell, or how does this work? I know I always get forecasts for our games, and it's like no pressure, you have to sell.
And how accurate are those forecasts, really?
That's a question, because
how can you really determine that?
It depends on the quality of your team. I mean, I've actually been amazed by how accurately some of these guys
can really get
it. Yeah.
So we've got a team of people that essentially are plugged into the matrix, and they sit there and they look at numbers all day.
I mean, that's what I'm guessing you have to be, right?
And they're good at their job.
Yeah.
They model, they forecast based on all sorts of stuff, based on past history, based on competitive product. And yeah, it's, most of the time they're able to kind of pin it right there.
Wow.
But it kind of depends company to company as well. I mean, we've got a finance team that does a lot of our forecasting. The sales team, we're pretty locked in with because they're looking to us for what is this thing? How do we sell it? What's unique about it? Why are the retailers going to care about it? And that's our job to go in and say, this is why this thing's hot. Go tell the retailers.
So now I know you can't mention product names here, but I got to ask, has there ever been just a real turd that you've worked on that you had to put a smile on your face and go out and sell, even though you knew it was...
Yes.
I'm guessing that's like more than one, maybe.
So how do you
keep in mind when I started the industry and where the industry was in the 90s and early 2000s, there was a lot of shuffleware. Like just,
I mean, you know, I'm sure a certain girl band themed product may have been challenging.
No, believe it or not. So that wasn't challenging from a quality standpoint. That was challenging because I was at the time a 25 year old guy trying to market a game that was targeted to an 11 or 12 year old girl. That's not my area of expertise. Yeah,
didn't make you look creepy at all.
No, you know, coming up. So this is back in the days when print magazines were still a big deal and you make a print ad, right? And put it in Cosmo magazine.
Oh yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Because I know you're an avid reader of Cosmo.
Yes. That was a challenge, but hey, it was fun. That's what I love about my job is it's, you know, there's always a challenge there. And if you can come out the other side on the positive end, like that's a big win.
Yeah, sure. So how do marketing budgets get established? So it's kind of some background on development. I mean, whenever I've shipped a game that didn't really meet critical acclaim, I guess, you know, it's always been blamed on marketing. Like, oh, if we just would have...
It's always marketing's fault.
Yeah, if we just would have spent more, you know, advertising this, it would have sold better. Of course, that's probably...
You didn't appeal to enough people.
Never the case. But how do you get... Because marketing budgets can be huge. It could be tens of millions of dollars on games nowadays.
They can be. They can also be... Not
going door to door with
which is really challenging in today's kind of landscape. Yeah,
I mean, to fight for that. I mean, how do you?
Yeah, you know, sometimes.
Yeah,
sometimes. You know, I guess there's like an industry average, right? And that's all based on how much revenue they think they're going to bring in. You have your development cost. You have your marketing cost, which is a percentage of the development, and then they need to figure out where the profit's going to be, right? And then they have to decide, do we need to pump more into this because we feel it's got an upside, or we're not really sure about the quality, so we're going to spend down here. Or we're going to spend a ton of money on a shit product and hope it sticks. The industry's seen their share of those.
And have you ever misjudged? Have you ever spent too much on a product that just didn't do well?
It depends on your definition of too much. I've always been challenged with trying to do a lot with a little, which is you know, again, it's a challenge. And if you can add to the bottom line without spending a ton of money, that makes you look good. But there are other games that spend tens of millions of dollars in marketing just in North America alone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes they hit and sometimes they fail miserably.
Well, I mean, that's like movies, you know, that where some marketing budgets on movies are greater than the development.
Yeah, the budget. Same or greater than the actual cost of production. Yeah.
It's tough now, though. I mean, you've been in the industry long enough. Everybody tries to put all their stuff out at the holidays, right?
Oh, yeah.
So your share of voices can only go so far.
It's so saturated. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So in order to break through, you got to spend more and more and more and more and everything. Yeah. Now everybody's wised up and they're like, well, we know this is going to cut. So everybody's, you know, racking up their rates in the holidays. So it's just kind of it's not necessarily the Wild West, but it's brutal trying to compete.
Oh God, I'd have to imagine. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, from the development side, we don't really see that, right? Like, we're usually so heads down and actually probably so burnt out by the time it even,
right.
You know, by the time we hand it off to you guys, there's a lot of what you do that we just don't get visibility to.
Yeah. It's at that point where you guys kind of bring your heads up and keep your fingers crossed. And please, please, please work.
So how has the landscape changed? I mean, you mentioned, you know, doing a lot of print stuff back in the late 90s and early 2000s. Now, you know, there's so much online presence, you know, digital distribution, all that sort of stuff. How has it changed?
I mean, technology, social media in the last 10, 15 years, like I looked at something the other day. Our digital marketing team brought up some research and it was like the average attention span of a human being 15 years ago was 12 seconds.
Really?
Yeah. As of a couple of years ago, it was eight seconds. And the average attention span of a goldfish is 9 seconds.
So we've actually gotten worse than goldfish now.
Right? That was a study Microsoft did. It wasn't somebody that somebody made something up. They put this out as research. And it's like, oh my God, the amount of stuff at our disposal, right? So back in the day, it was you had your computer gaming magazines. Mm-hmm. Just put your ad in there and it'll work. And put an ad on TV and that'll work. Nobody's watching TV anymore. Everybody's got their phone. Everybody's on whatever gram book thing is the next thing, right?
You sound really old.
I know. I'm just trying to, and I know what they all are. I'm just trying to summarize. But you can't just do a TV ad anymore. You can't just do a print ad. You have to know who your customer is. You got to know where they're at, what they're watching, where they're going to be, what their interests are. So you got to spend a ton of money on research, identifying who all these groups are. And then figure out how to get them and at what point along the way you got to get them.
So do you actually design like viral marketing campaigns at all? Is that a thing?
I'm not a believer. I actually don't believe you can create a viral marketing campaign.
Really?
Yeah. You can create something that might go viral.
Okay.
But if you try to set out to do it? No, if you try to make something viral, you're going to fail. You're trying too hard.
I mean, I don't have any counterpoint to that. I sit in my office and write code.
I've got a bunch of examples of things that companies I've worked for in the past have tried to do viral campaigns, and it's, you know, two marketing guys sitting in a room thinking, oh, this is going to work.
It probably has just the stink of being manufactured.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. It's got to be authentic. It has to hit at the right time. It's got to capture, you know, the zeitgeist, and then it just takes a wave and runs. Mm-hmm. But if you try too hard, you're just going to come off as, you know, inauthentic, and everybody can see that stuff now.
Do you have any stories from your past or even things that you've witnessed that were just horrible misjudgments? I mean, anything that, like, I remember reading up on advertising, and there was the old Infiniti ads for the cars when it first came out, and their whole marketing campaign was to not show the car in the commercials. Mm-hmm. And I think that first year they sold like 3 cars. they thought they were being like so mysterious.
Yeah, whoever came up with that was like, this is going to be genius.
Sell the mystique. Yeah. And yet I'm spending $40,000 on something I need to see.
Yeah, I remember seeing those ads and I didn't even know what the hell it was for. I didn't know it didn't even show cars. It was like pans of landscapes and this weird stuff. So
there's everybody's guilty of hopping on a bandwagon, right? And then just getting on the wagon too late. And then trying to ride a wave. Like, now.
Well, you were like trying to write a rap for the kids?
Well, I mean, back in the 90s, everybody used pop music for a trailer, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we need to have the big thing that and it's like, well, who are you going for? Like, you can't just randomly pull some piece of music and expect it to hit everyone.
Right.
there's also, you know, genre trends. Like when I worked at Konami, we made a lot of music games.
Sure.
We had DDR. I worked on Karaoke Revolution.
You know, I pitched a karaoke game years ago to Nintendo, and it was awesome. It worked, and they completely laughed me out of the building. I got nothing out of it, and it was a vindication to see that game come out. Like, I was visionary. I wasn't a shitty game maker. It was just too early.
Well, I think we pitched a game to at one point, and they did not take it, and then they ended up producing a very similar product. So you know, everybody's guilty of hopping on a trend and a bandwagon, but sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Now everybody's on this battle royale kick, right?
Yeah, oh, sure. Yeah.
Fortnite,
and right.
So now everybody's trying to plug that into their game and hope it's a success, but I don't know. I don't know if it's going to work.
Really?
Because you've already got the tip of the spear, right? You've got Fortnite and you've got PUBG and things like that, but all the other games are now fighting to compete, and I don't know if plugging those things in is really going to work.
Right. I mean, I've had, you know, the numerous examples of that from development where, you know, you're working on a racing game and somebody sees something in the cool, you know, new movie that's out. Oh, we got to do this now. You know, we need a jump cam, or we need to do burnouts in the game. That's the big thing. And you're like, okay, can't we just like stick to what it's, we yeah, set out to do?
Find your thing and just make that thing better. Like, once you start to try to be everything else, you kind of lose the identity of what that game is. Right. And then my job as a marketer becomes a lot harder, because then it's like, well, how do you not look like you're copying something?
Yep.
By plugging that into the campaign.
So. Yeah, sure. So, I don't know when this will actually go out, but we're sitting in the week before E3, and I know I've seen you at E3 many times. In fact, you sneaked me into to a product demo a couple of years ago. Thank you for not having me wait in line.
VIP.
Oh, I feel so good about myself.
Well timed.
So let's talk E3 show floor horror stories, because this is the one thing that I've always been happy about, that I've gone to almost every E3. I've never once had to work it, and I have seen you guys
are a lucky man,
and your brother, and you know, some of our friends, Andy and those guys, after, you know, 3 days of constant hangovers and having to sit on the floor for what, 8-10 hours, and just be on your game and talk to cameras. So what's that? How exhausting is that?
So I am now old, air quotes, and jaded after 22 years of doing this. There was a period of time, I think, where I attended 17 straight E3s. And
yeah, that sounds about right.
Most of those, at least in the early days, were all, I'm on the floor 8 hours a day, demoing games, talking to sales reps and buyers from Walmart and GameStop and Best Buy and whatever. And in the early days, like working at Psygnosis, I actually had to help with booth setup.
Oh, yeah.
So like their early horror stories of going to Atlanta, setting up the booth, making sure the code's working right. And then there's some disaster where they shut off the AC in the building while they're doing setup because it was so hot
in Atlanta in the summer.
Yeah. And what happens the night of, in order to get everything going, they crank up the AC in the place and in the booth, and pipes burst and, you know, water pouring down from the booth. So everyone that's in the booth has to do cleanup. I didn't get back to my hotel room that night until 6 a.m.
Oh, and then he had to work the next
day? I walked into the room, literally face planted onto the bed at the time my roommate's alarm clock went off. And my roommate was my manager, my boss at the time. He looks over and he goes, "No." Am I like, yeah? And I was supposed to be on the floor in 2 hours for setup.
Oh, man.
So I got 2 hours of sleep, had to go back to the floor, demo for 8 hours. And then, of course, as you say, what do you do when the show's done? You go out,
yep,
you eat. Back then, companies were spending ridiculous amounts of money.
Oh, well, the parties were insane.
So we would gorge ourselves at dinner and then go out to a party and drink all night on somebody else's dime.
Yeah.
And then 3 o'clock in the morning, roll back into the hotel, pass out, get up at 7 a.m, back to the, you know, it was just like rinse and repeat. I can't do that anymore.
There's a famous picture. We're actually having our friend Andy Bodwin on the podcast at E3. At least I hope we are. He's on the schedule, at least. We'll see how his show goes. But there's a famous picture of him. He was demoing Motor City Online back in the EA days. And it was like, it was on a Japanese website. And it just had a picture of him next to the game. And it was, I think it was the last interview of the last day of E3. and he looked horrible.
Just like, looked like he got hit by a truck.
Ruined.
Oh yeah, just bloodshot eyes and big bags under. I mean, he looked like he was asleep on his feet, and it's a classic picture. We'll have to see if we can find it. Maybe we'll stick it on the webpage. But you could just, even if you don't know anything about Andy or anything about E3, you could just read the whole story in his face.
There's a lot of people you can see that at the show. I think things have changed. I mean, in the late 90s, early 2000s, E3 was just, it was a madhouse.
Yeah.
Well, babes everywhere, scantily clad people.
They used to have that, the God lot across the street. Do you remember that? The gathering developers.
Yeah, and I've had this conversation a couple times this week about that very
what
thing.
What is the God lot?
I guess they were a publisher called Gathering of Developers, right, where they were kind of a loosely banded together group of independent game developers. And yeah, they would rent the parking lot across the street.
The parking lot.
Yeah. And it was they had schoolgirl outfits.
I remember this year. You're on the right track. I got on the bus. I can't remember which company I was at the time, but we had just finished up. It was the last day of the show. We get on the bus and we're right across the street from the parking lot that you're talking about. And they've got, like, I don't know, RVs or Airstreams or whatever out in the parking lot. And there's something being played on a projector screen on a brick wall of a building. And I'm looking at it going, that looks an awful lot like some softcore porn thing that you'd watch on, you know, late night Cinemax or whatever. And it literally was.
And girls, this is out in the open.
This is out
this
in
is
the
downtown
open
LA.
In downtown LA. And this is coming from a video game publisher lot. There's girls dressed in schoolgirl outfits. There's little people coming in the room. And it's like, oh my God. What the fuck is going on with this industry?
And it was free booze all day long. They had a bar that you could just walk in. If you had an E3 pass, you just walk in.
It's like the Wild West.
Like they were showing game footage on the wall. They were appealing to a different audience. Or celebrating the fact that E3 was over. It was nuts.
Well, anything to get people in the booth, right?
I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, we used to walk down the halls of E3 and you'd see girls you can't even describe them as thongs. Like,
oh, it was crazy.
With like Victoria's Secret angel wings. And what fucking game are you promoting? I mean, we were guilty. We had Lara Croft in our booth at IDOS for a number of years, but it was never that bad.
In my younger days, that was always a nice demo to witness.
Yeah.
The real life Lara Croft.
But nowadays you go into E3, there's no such thing as a booth babe anymore. It's put the focus on the game and not
trying to lure people. It got so excessive and so ridiculous to where it was, it was blatant misogyny.
Yeah.
How do we get people into our booth? Find some nearly naked girl and put her at the front of the booth throwing out t-shirts to sweaty industry guys, and suddenly your booth would be full.
It's totally true. I remember we've told a couple of CCP stories already on the podcast, but I remember one of the CCP parties was I think it was kind of bondage themed. So they had a professional dominatrix there, and people were executives at the company were.
I'm not shitting you. Somebody told me this story last week.
Yeah, yeah, and there were there also little people, which is I guess a theme in our industry.
Yep.
With super soakers full of vodka, and they would come by and
I know two people that were at this party with you.
And they had, I believe they had a tattoo artist there. You can get Eve online tattoos for free.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would go in there and get hammered off of Super Soaker booze.
Wind up with a tattoo.
And wind up with an EVE Online tattoo. So, there were definitely some...
Have you met anyone in the last few years that still has an EVE Online tattoo?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, I did. I'm surprised I don't at this point, actually. I've got some stupid tattoos, but I don't have that one yet. Yeah, so there was actually a time in the E3 history where they basically shut it down, right? Oh, thank you, John.
Yeah, that was weird. That was like 2007?
And it was
2008.
It was just a closed door.
So they moved it. One year they moved out to Santa Monica, and I think that was 2007. They moved out to Santa Monica, and they kind of broke it up into a bunch of small areas, and then they did like a hands-on area out at an old small airport hangar somewhere.
Okay.
So everyone was needing to get bussed around, and it was just, after all those years of E3, it felt weird. Like,
yeah,
all the press were kind of bouncing around, and then you go to this little tiny little hangar, and everyone's kind of crammed in there, and everyone's like, this isn't E3. Then they moved it back to the LA Convention Center the following year in 2008, but they didn't open the big floors, like the halls. Everyone just had little rooms.
Oh, weird.
So we were going up the escalators into this tiny little, I don't know, 1,000-square-foot room, and you see the hall, like the West Hall, open.
And just
concrete. And it's like, what has happened to our industry? Like, it's all gone away.
Well, I mean, I'm sure, you know, most video game fans have at least seen pictures or, you know, footage from E3. But the people spend millions on their booths there. I mean, they're these monolithic structures.
And the crazy thing is, you're spending millions of dollars on a booth, and it's not a consumer show.
Yeah, you're right.
So, yeah, who are you trying to... there's buyers, right?
There's buyers, which... Don't get me wrong. It is a really important trade show, right?
And journalists.
Journalists.
So you're building buzz is what it's about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then it became a spending spree. That's why in 2007 they moved it off site, because it was, A, people were using booth babes. It was getting ridiculous. Right. And, you know, that kind of era passed. But then people were spending tens of millions of dollars on booths and booth designs, and it still goes on.
I mean, really, tens of millions.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's like an insane amount of money to spend. Yeah. Up for what, 3 days?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And massive statues. I mean, hey, the companies I work for, we still make statues. We still do the big booths, but it all kind of serves a purpose. And now E3 is open to the public. So you kind of make use of it. But you still have to now weigh the cost of doing that, because we're all in the business of making games and making money, right? But so... you can't spend $10 million on a booth and then wall it off and have it be VIP only. That's not a great use of money.
Now, do you guys have a booth this year?
As a label, no.
Okay.
But business stuff, you know.
So you're not working this year. You get to actually do the fun stuff.
Well, it's research, and I'm not blowing smoke up your butt. I'm
get to play video games for research.
I'm gonna attend a first party conference, and you know, after 22 years, it's my first time going to a conference, so it's actually gonna be cool to see like how that all works. And I still enjoy going, and hopefully before the public comes in, be able to go see some competitive games and, you know, see what all the hubbub's about.
Right, right.
Because I'm still a gaming geek at heart. I'd love to be able to go and see stuff, but I don't want to stand in line for 5 hours because I've got better things to do with my time.
I'm so jaded. I know. I think you showed me Civ 6.
Yeah, a couple of years ago.
Civilization is one of my favorite games ever, and I was so excited for that game to come out, and I looked at the line and I was like, fuck that. I'm not even waiting.
Yep.
And then I saw you and I'm like, I'm saved.
So a common thread that's gone through your podcast is it's all about who you know and the relationships you make and not pissing people off and burning bridges. Yep. And it's true. Like, you know, I still know people at other companies, and hopefully if they're at E3, I can walk up and say, can I just get in? You know, can I get in and see this thing?
Nudge.
Yeah, exactly.
Piss all the fans off who are paying money to buy your product.
Well, hopefully I can do that before the fans come in. I'm just pissing off some editors.
I think we're going to have to mask out your face on the promo picture for this podcast so people don't know what you look like.
I'll be wearing a mask at E3.
All right. Why don't we take a little break and we'll come back. I want to hear some more stories, and then I want to get into some advice for people who want to get into the wacky world of video game marketing.
Sounds good.
All right. We'll be back.
All right. We'll be right back. Let's listen to this message from our very important sponsor.
The D3 Podcast is brought to you by Ketchikan Charter, the finest charter fishing company in Ketchikan, Alaska. If you want to be called a ho-ho-eating motherfucker by a big Alaskan man, go to ketchikancharter.com. You ever been told to pick up the cocksucker by a guy who wears exclusively Star Wars t-shirts? Go to ketchikancharter.com.
I'm going. I'm sold.
Oh, I love Bill. Hey, we're back.
That was a great message from our sponsor there.
Yeah, thank you, Ketchikan Charter.
Yeah.
Up in Alaska.
I'm bound to get my way up there and go on that.
You got to come up.
I really want to go too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It sounds great.
It's a bucket list thing to go deep sea fishing and to go to Alaska. So why not combine them both?
Oh, God. And the booze and the yelling. And it's an amazing time. Yeah, you got to come up. So let's talk. Like I said, it's the perception of developers that you guys get to do all the cool stuff. And I know I've seen...
That's one perception of the marketing team. I know there's a negative, another negative perception of marketing.
Okay, but what's the coolest stuff you've done? Because I know, like, when I was working on the SOCOM games, the marketing guys would go out to the Nevada desert with the Navy SEALs and blow stuff up while we were sweating back at the office fixing bugs. And I know, I know people who've gone, you know, racing Ferraris on the test track in Italy. And
so, God, it's been so long since I've actually done anything like that. But I do remember when back in the day when I worked at Psygnosis, we were working on a racing game. It was called Newman Haas Racing. It was a Indy kart game.
Oh, nice.
And we went out to, I forget what it was called at the time. Now it's Sonoma Raceway, and went out racing around in Mustangs around the track, which was kind of cool because I'd never done anything like that before.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And what, do you guys film the stuff and use
it?
No,
it was just a day out at the races.
See, you guys do get to do all the cool stuff.
Most of the cool stuff I get to do, somebody else is paying for.
Well, like, yeah, I'm sure.
Being a marketing, the companies we work for spend a lot of money with media teams and on ads. So the ad reps, you know, in return want to woo their clients, and they take us out and do really cool things. And it was about 4 or 5 months ago, went back to Sonoma Raceway.
Oh, yeah?
But this time, I got to be in a much cooler car.
All right. So what kind of car were you driving around the racetrack?
We got to drive McLarens.
What?
Yeah.
That's
I had no idea what I was getting into, and yeah. That was my reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, I mean, the last time I'd been on the track was in a Ford Mustang GT convertible. To get dropped in a McLaren and literally drive it around the track behind a professional. The way this worked was we were like on the little area, like the safe area, right? To make sure you can handle the car and go through the cones. And then once you do that, then you can go out on the actual track and they have a professional driver in the lead car.
Okay.
And then you and another car behind him. And you're literally following him around as he's describing, all right, here we go, turn one. Here we come to turn two. Gas, 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 brake, brake, brake. And I was like, holy shit, this is really cool. And you do that 3 times. And by the time you're done, you're literally going 100 and whatever miles an hour around these turns. And you feel like you're a professional race car.
Wow.
Like, that was cool.
Did you ever feel like out of control? Were you ever at a point where you're like, I better bring it in a little bit because I'm going to smash this million-dollar car?
No. Because even if I crashed it, they were insured, so it was all right. I'm not an idiot when I drive, but I never felt like I was in danger. But it was like just awe of like cruising around in this $160,000 car, $200,000 car, nuts.
Well, I know your brother works on Forza, and I always see him posting pictures
of cool shit.
Yeah, just him standing next to, you know, Ferraris.
He gets to go out on rally courses and do all this cool stuff and meet all these guys that are, you know, with all these fancy cars. And, you know, I forget what the name of it is, like the Hoonigan guys or whatever, you know, all their fancy cars, and he drives an old classic car. So it's like my brother's a gearhead.
Yeah, he definitely is. It's funny because, you know, we were talking about E3 being a developer, you know, that show isn't about development. So even though I've been in the industry a long time, I always feel like they're like, here comes a developer. Like, what's he doing? He's not, you know, he's not a buyer. He's not an executive. He's not in marketing. So I still have to beg for the passes to the cool stuff.
It's kind of weird because nobody can talk to the game and show the game like the development team, and they don't get to experience all the cool stuff that all the guys that are spending all the money get to do.
Yeah.
Which is a bit unfair. I went through that at one of my former companies. We would throw a massive party every year, and we'd have guys busting their ass on the floor, you know, QA guys, product development guys, producers. They get there at 7 a.m, they're working all day, done at night, and they don't get an invite to the party.
Oh, that's really not fair.
Yeah.
At the expense of somebody's friend in another company coming to the party.
Yeah,
it's like,
sure.
That's fucked up. Like, these guys have been busting their asses all day. Like, let them enjoy it and have a good time. And yeah, but that was back in the day when it was all hierarchical. And
yeah, yeah, yeah. There's definitely E3 is thick with politics.
Indeed.
So you,
some things never change.
A common theme through the podcast and through the industry is lots of booze. Have you ever gotten a little too out of control at any of these things?
I know when to say when. I have had years where I've had a really good time into the wee hours of the morning, but get back into the, you know, I'm suffering a hangover, but I don't let anybody know I've had a hangover. I have worked at companies where other people were not so lucky. They went out and they would get hammered and they wouldn't go to sleep and they would come back to the booth and then end up puking on the floor and get fired on the spot. So it's like,
oh, really?
Yeah. I forget what the saying is, but one of the companies I worked at, it was like, you know, the show does not recognize hangovers. So it's like, just be responsible, come do your job and go have fun, but don't do that.
Wow. I know I'm not going to spoil the story because we want to have John tell it when he gets on the podcast. But John has a very good drunken story about knocking over a very famous movie director, which I know that...
I'm not going to spoil that one, but I know what you're talking about.
So, yeah, mistakes happen occasionally. But
yes, on occasion, yes.
So,
and
yeah.
He's still employed.
Yeah. Yeah, I luckily haven't had that experience, and I've never, like I said, I've never had responsibilities. So,
yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I've had really kind of bad experiences off-site, but never at the show where I would get in trouble for it. I was smart enough to protect myself.
So one thing, it used to be more prevalent at E3 and at these shows, everybody always gives away swag. Have you ever gotten a bit of swag that stands out?
Nobody really gives away swag anymore. It was like back in the 90s and early 2000s where people used to do that.
Yeah, there was some crazy stuff.
I do have a swag story. It wasn't anything that I got. When I worked at IDOS, we did a game that was licensed. It was the 101 or 102 Dalmatians game that was based on the movie. And we had this booth set up and we had stuffed animals everywhere. And on the last day of the show... Keep in mind, this is not a consumer show. This is a bunch of industry professionals and press professionals. People were stealing shit off the booth. Like literally grabbing stuffed animal Dalmatians and walking out as if they were entitled to that thing.
They deserve it. Yeah.
Wow.
Trade show mentality.
Yeah, that's ballsy. I don't remember what show it was. It was either GDC or E3. And somebody, I don't remember the company or the game, but they were giving out what looked like sticks of dynamite. They were like red tubes with like a wick on them. And then,
I don't think you'd get away with that today.
But what was hilarious, it was a really cool, they were cool. So everybody wanted to get the stick of dynamite and everybody had them. But whatever company I was with at the time, we all flew back together from wherever. But airport security... As we were all going through it, everybody had these sticks of dynamite, and they
was
all
this
got
pre or post 2001.
I'm pretty sure it was post. The cops were called in because everybody had these explosive looking devices in their bags. I guess there's a marketing faux pas. Don't give away weapons.
No. I do remember there were some companies that shall remain nameless giving away you could blow them up and you'd have like an axe or a sword. But again, think of your audience. This isn't a consumer show. You're essentially giving away swag to a guy that works at a website or somebody that works at a retailer. And nowadays, people stop giving away swag and they just serve booze in there after 5 o'clock in their booth.
I could remember some of the inflatable swords and seeing lots of drunken inflatable sword fights at the parties.
I do remember seeing just a lot of shit get thrown on the floor. Like when you leave the show floor, everybody
it's just
got their swag.
With just,
so stickers.
They're just like,
bags.
I don't want this.
Yeah, I'm not going to take this to my next place.
Let's just throw it right here.
So you'd leave the show floor and there'd just be a sea of pamphlets and stickers and inflatable things and t-shirts.
Yeah. Right.
I remember Nintendo one year, they had a Pokemon thing, a promotion, and it was this big kind of installation where there was, like, I don't know, there was some like smoke and some stuff happening in a big thing and all the smoke would pop up and these little stuffed Pokeballs would shoot out and they were the little Pokeballs and they had a zipper in them and you could flip them inside out and they were one of the characters. But they would do this like every half hour on the half hour or whatever it was, and they would just shoot these things out in the audience, but they were so popular that there were basically riots over these things, and like people I had heard somebody in a wheelchair got knocked over people scampering for these things. So I remember, I think the third day they actually had to turn it off, and they just they were just handing them out to people. Again, not good to cause mass panic.
I've never been to Gamescom, but I've been to like PAX before in Boston and Seattle, and you go to these consumer shows, and when you start throwing free stuff out, people don't care what it is.
Oh, yeah.
They just see you throwing stuff.
Yep.
And it's like you say, it's a riot. People are literally jumping over each other trying to get a pen or a squishy ball or a sticker. Like
human psychology, I guess, right?
I guess.
Yeah. So what are the big shows? That's interesting that you mentioned that because, I mean, for me as a developer, it's always been GDC and E3. But yeah, so there's Gamescom that's in Germany, right?
That's probably pretty important to be at, right?
It is. I guess if you follow the trend of game development, most games come out in the fall, right? So at E3, the developers are shitting themselves trying to figure out how to get a game demo ready to show in May.
Oh, yeah.
But by the time August rolls around, it's like, shit, our game's almost at, you know, it's almost ready to go off to manufacturing. We'll go. We'll show stuff. And you've got, I don't know what the number is now. It's like hundreds of thousands of people over the course of three days, I think.
Yeah.
Descend in Germany and just go nuts.
Wow.
And it's kind of like, if you look at the video and highlights of it, it kind of reminds me of the 1990s E3, except that was all just press and editors, press and buyers.
And it's consumers.
Consumers, and they separate it out. They do a consumer bit, and they do a what they call the business day or whatever. They bring all the people out there. But yeah, it's hundreds of thousands of people. So there's Gamescom. E3 is now a consumer thing. They've opened it up. Consumers, they're kind of testing the waters with it. PAX is still big in Seattle.
Yeah. Well, there's PAX East and Boston.
PAX East and Boston. They've started one in San Antonio over the last couple of years. PAX South.
Yeah.
It's kind of earlier in the year.
And then there's lots of kind of private publisher stuff. Like we have QuakeCon. That's a big one for
us. QuakeCon, BlizzCon. Yeah. And now people are, you know, companies like EA and Activision are kind of pulling themselves out of the show floor at E3 and kind of doing their own offsite thing at E3 now. They create this massive experience where people can come and just focus on their games.
Yeah, it's nuts how far it's come.
Oh, yeah.
So, actually, have you ever gotten in trouble with the dev teams by maybe talking up too much or by maybe saying something that wasn't exactly true about the game?
Yeah, saying some inaccurate information about a game. Yeah, that's happened once or twice.
I remember you...
Not recently.
I won't mention the product that this was for, but it was when I was pretty young and it was in it was the big product unveiling in Tokyo. And I was sitting with the engineering team and the marketing guys were up on stage at this big press conference and they were talking about all the features of the product. And I remember they got kind of down the list and I just look at the guy next to me and I'm like, did we do that? Did we actually write that into this?
Wasn't even implemented.
He's like, no, they're making this stuff up now. And we had to like sit there and smile and applaud and then hightail it back to the hotel to figure out how in the hell we could implement these features that they just told us we needed to have.
I do remember, must have been an E3. I got interviewed by somebody at E3, and this was back in the day before anybody recorded it, thankfully. So there's no actual proof of it, but I do remember getting a call from development studio the day after the news story broke online. It, you know, it was posted online and it was a quote that some guy had written on what I had said. And I'm like, I don't remember. I didn't say that. I didn't misrepresent the game, but the guy actually severely misquoted me. So I had to get back on the phone with him and like, dude, I did not say that. So you need to go and correct that shit online.
Well, luckily it was online enough.
What did he say? He was like, oh.
Yeah, we had a chat about it, but I was like, yeah, you didn't have that right.
Do people get on the shit list if somebody does that? Do you have like a list of people?
Well, nowadays people get recorded, so it's proof if you actually fuck up.
Right.
So if the developer calls you out on something, you're like, I didn't say that. Watch this video.
God, that's got to be nerve-wracking.
No, I've been nervous about not saying the right thing. I mean, look, when I at 2K for the last 6 years, I've worked on all the Firaxis titles. So I spent a lot of time working on XCOM and Civ. Mm-hmm. And when I was put on those titles, the only turn-based strategy game I had ever played in my life before putting on those games was chess. So talk about being a fish out of water.
Like, right.
I have to learn the language. And so there were a couple of years where I was really nervous to do interviews about stuff. Like, it's like, just go talk to the PR person. Totally comfortable with it now. But yeah, you have to earn the respect of those guys. And if you speak out of turn, you can do some damage and credibility as a marketing guy.
Oh, yeah. Now, when you're doing this stuff like at E3, I mean, you're doing interview after interview after interview or product demos.
Not so much anymore.
But when you did that, would you have kind of a rehearsed spiel you would give? Okay.
Yeah.
Because like we go 90 minutes on this podcast, and I can't remember what I've already said. I have no idea how you do it over 3 days and just keep a consistent message.
One thing I learned early on in my career was don't memorize the script, because you'll always screw up. It's just learn the talking points and then just be yourself. And it actually makes things a lot easier if you can just remember bullet points. Like, I know I need to cover this, 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 and this. And if you know the game inside and out, and that's the thing about on the marketing side of things, if you're not playing the games, it's really tough to be credible. Like, the dev team needs to know you're playing their game.
Yeah.
Right. But they also need to know that you have a view of other things going on in the industry and you can relate to things. So if you're not playing the games and then you're starting to interview and you're like, bullet point A, bullet point B, bullet point C, everybody can see through that. But yeah, there have been times early in my career where I was trying to memorize a script and I just hit a wall. I forgot what I was supposed to say. Oh, shit.
Have you ever had any product demos go south on you? I mean, I know I remember what we were demoing.
Yes.
We were demoing a big online game at one of the big keynote press conferences at E3, and it was a game. Most people who are looking at game demos aren't used to seeing games in development. Mm-hmm. You know, we're used to it. We're used to seeing stuff go wrong, seeing stuff crash and whatever, but we knew that this game was... It made it out, and we knew it was going to make it, but it wasn't quite stable. And I remember we had 8 people on stage playing the game, and 6 of the machines crashed while they were on the big screen, and we were able just to fail over through all 6 of them, and no one ever noticed.
Nice. Good recovery.
But, we were just sitting back there like, oh, my God, they hit that crash. How they hit that crash?
Yeah, there were times, you know, without getting overly specific, working on a very popular third-person action-adventure game, that genre is prone for characters to jump and fall through the map.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Nothing worse than being at a massive trade show on camera demoing the game, and that shit happens. Yeah.
Can you control that? I mean, can you tell the press, like, if they see that happen, can you go, okay, guys, like, wink, cut that out. Don't show that to the public.
Well, there's always that, and there's always the, well, you know, it's still early in development.
Right.
We're not quite there yet. Yeah. But then all that stuff's caught on camera, the awkward reaction.
Oh, yeah.
How do you come back from that?
Yeah, I've seen a number of those.
Most recently, though, I think we had something like 30 game stations set up at a consumer show, and I don't think the fans were working to like pull the heat out from where the machines are. And it would be this randomness of machine shutdown, machine shutdown, machine shutdown. And then you reboot the machines, and then the next 4 or 5 would shut down. And so we'd spend 3 hours rotating around underneath, you know, opening boxes, telling people just wait 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a problem.
And you know, people wait hours to play these games at these shows. That's got to be frustrating for somebody who's waited 3 hours in line, and they get up there and the machine blows up.
I mean, they get to stay there. That's a good thing. But yeah, I mean, yeah, to your point, you go to these consumer shows now, and it's great for us because the door opens at 10 or 9 or whatever time. And by 10:30, there is a 4.5 hour long wait to go in and see a staged demonstration that we're putting together. And yet people will line up.
So
sometimes they'll do it and they'll go back in line.
Yeah.
So is it's all demonstrations, or it's actual, you can, like a setup that you can play?
Yeah, it depends on the game. But sometimes we will do like a theater demonstration, because oftentimes you can't get 15, 20 minutes isn't enough time, especially on some of the games I work on. There's 20 minutes isn't enough time to get through that.
Civ 6 was like that. You guys had a theater.
Yeah. And so we choreographed a presentation that would show you the promise of what the game was. It was all game footage,
and
but
you
it
just
was
repeated
all,
every.
Yeah. I mean, it was all game footage, and it was narrated together, but it was a scripted thing so that we could show you what a 3 hour experience looks like in 10 minutes.
Right.
But there are other games where people go and they'll stand in line to get 10 minutes hands on time.
Yeah.
And they'll just sit there on the concrete floor waiting and waiting and waiting for the line to slowly move around. And then when they're done, they'll do it again.
Yeah.
And the show's only 8 hours long. So you've spent your entire day standing in line for 20 minutes to play one game. It's nuts that people do that.
I think last year we had Wolfenstein I think it was Wolfenstein last year. But yeah, we had that at the ZeniMax Bethesda booth where I think, the show opens whenever it is, but by like lunch, they had shut off the line because it was going to take the person who was last in line all the way until show closed to get through and play the game.
But people are so... It's cool that people want to see your game so much that they will dedicate that much of their life to spend 10 minutes with it. And then you hope when they're done, just buy the game.
Right. And then that's why I feel like such an asshole, like, you know, going in and, hey, Matt, what's up? I'm just going to skip the line and go in there, sit in the back.
That's why you get there before the consumers. But
yeah. Luckily, E3 has the exhibitor's pass. Mm-hmm. If your company is there, you get to get in a little bit early and check stuff out.
It always pays to know people. That's what I'm saying.
So let's talk a little bit about future stuff and where the industry is going. I mean, we joke about playing games for research, but you do a lot of research and you kind of know, you know, at least where the market's at, and I'm sure you have to predict where it's going. What you mentioned, the battle games that are out now, PUBG and Fortnite. What's the next big thing? What do you think? Is it esports? Is it VR? Is it AR?
I mean, esports is always going to be there, right? You have to have the right type of game and right type of presentation to capitalize on that thing. I mean, the company I work for, just it's crazy that video games have now gone mainstream. Blizzard's done this for years, right? Yeah. But 2K just did a thing with the NBA, and we've got this NBA 2K league, and we've got people that are like sent off to a house and they paid money, a salary, to play video games against other people. Like,
crazy. And they play some sort of league that plays against other people.
Yeah. Adam Silver ran a video game draft. The commissioner of the NBA.
Wow.
Drafted the first few guys. That's incredible. Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to ask about was Twitch and these sort of streamers and how marketing, you know, how you guys utilize those sort of influencers, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, obviously, but you know, how is that from your perspective?
It's tough. I mean, every publisher has their own guidelines and how they utilize it. It's a critical piece of the puzzle. And unfortunately, in the last few years, there have been cases of people that have worked with a certain influencer, and then that influencer has gone and done something stupid, but they're forever connected to the thing that they were promoting. And they say some racist remark or do something stupid on Twitter, and it comes back to bite. So there's always that, you know, how much do we do this?
Who are you really dealing with here? Yeah. But I guess it's the same when you, I guess when you like a sponsor an athlete or you sponsor.
Yeah, there's always risk.
There's always risk.
Yeah. But it's important, right? Because our consumers aren't watching, you know, they're not reading the video game channels every day. They're not reading a magazine anymore. What are they doing? They're on YouTube. They're on Twitch. My nephews watch, I forget the guy's name, but he's on Twitch and he's really big with Fortnite. And they watch him all the time. If I want to address my nephews on a game as a random marketer, I need to talk to that guy and I need to get him interested in my game. Otherwise, they're never going to know about it.
Right.
He's the influencer.
Right.
And then it's a balance of, you know, is that something you pay for? Or is that something you just bring him in and make him feel special and get him early access to the game and hope that he covers
how
it?
I'm really curious about how you sort of navigate that sort of relationship. But I guess it's different probably for each
it person. Is. Every company's got their ways of handling it. But I mean, the takeaway is it's just such a big piece of the puzzle now, because every time we do research for anyone that's, I don't know, 16 to in their early 30s, they get all their information from YouTube.
Yeah.
And they don't get it from a traditional show. It's from somebody else talking about something else. So you have to figure out in the sea of all this stuff, how do I find the right person that's going to authentically talk about my thing and get the people watching to go, oh, I need to pay attention to that.
Right.
Do you have people on staff who are plugged into that? Do you have people who like their job is to watch Twitch streams and then recognize who does what? And
we've got some guys that work on our communications team that are plugged into the matrix, and they've got all their data stuff, and you know, they'll whip up a magic list of, Game X, we've got a list of 30 guys we're going to go after. It's like, where'd you get that list? Doesn't matter.
It's but a science.
These people matter.
It's a science.
It is a science. Yeah. That sounds like all data driven now.
Yeah. Crazy dream job, like mattress tester, or like beer taster or something. Like you get paid to do what you would probably be doing for free.
I mean, shit, I wish I was good enough at video games to play them all the time and get paid advertising money.
Oh, that's crazy.
I mean, these guys, I just recently in the last year got into following Twitch streamers just because it's fucking insane that these guys spend, you know, 6-8 hours a day.
Yeah.
And they're building this incredible audience that the number of people watching them, I mean, it's on par with like sitcoms and like television. And that's insane to me.
And now people are tipping the streamers.
Well, listen, I've tipped streamers because they're fucking great. I mean, some of them are really
They're already getting paid ad dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
The consumers are basically chucking money.
They're chucking money. And if you watch, you know, $5, $5, $5, you know, it's amazing how it comes in. It fascinates me.
Yeah.
That's, it's, I remember joking, you know, in my early days of gaming, there was always the joke when I was kind of growing up and starting gaming of like, hey, let's go play football. Okay, cool. I'll get the cartridge. And you know, it was always the joke that, you know, why are you playing this game when you could actually go out in the yard and play football. And now it's one step removed from that. It's you're watching other people play the game where they could go out in the yard. And
I'll be honest, as a, I guess I can call myself an industry vet now. It's still weird that people invest the time to watch other people play for hours on end. I'll watch a little video to try and get me through an area I'm stuck in, but fascinating that people just watch esports and watch other people play games. It's a, it sucks being old because you disconnected from it.
I'm not plugged into the kind of the cutting edge of what's going on in the industry game wise anymore. I concentrate mostly on the tech, but I remember hearing about esports for the first time in a meeting. And I'm embarrassed even to admit when it was because it's way too recent. I'm way behind the times, but somebody said esports and I went, oh, like, you know, John Madden football, like that's, why are we talking about that? That's been around since, you know, the early 90s. And then they went into what it was and my jaw hit the floor. I'm like, this is a thing.
I just watched, I was at a industry conference and they brought somebody in from Blizzard talking about Overwatch.
Mm-hmm.
They have literally created an entire team that's focused on the Overwatch League brand. Like they've created a brand, they've created a channel, they've created partnerships and licensing. And it's mind blowing that you can build a business off just people playing your game and fill stadiums. And I'm not shitting. My introduction to esports, I went out to Korea a few years ago for a product.
Oh, it's huge over there.
People fill a fucking stadium of 80,000 people in Korea.
So there's like a soccer
to watch
stadium.
People play StarCraft 2, a game that's how old now? But I couldn't fathom it. Like a bunch of people just watching a bunch of dudes jamming on a keyboard and a mouse.
But they're superstars, right? I mean, the guys who are good at it are like celebrities.
Yeah.
So that's part of it.
Maybe it's because I'm on the business end of this whole thing for so long that you just miss this culture that's been created. But it's nuts that you could fit. It's like going to an NFL game, and instead of watching two teams beat each other up for 60 minutes, you're watching four guys play a video game.
Yeah.
But it's just as loud.
You know, I actually just saw, and I'm probably late to the party on this one too, but I think it was yesterday I saw a news story on University. I want to say it's University of Harrisburg. Forgive me if I got that wrong, but they're giving scholarships to esports athletes now.
Wow.
They're starting a collegiate esports team.
Wow.
Yeah.
And crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy talk.
My how the industry has grown.
Yeah. I mean, where was this when I was a kid?
That's what I'm saying.
My parents always yelled at me for wasting my life in front of a video game.
Do you remember the days when you used to sit on the couch with your friend and play a two-player multiplayer game?
Yeah. I do remember that.
Let's take a quick break.
Okay.
And then we'll be right back after this. Another great message from our sponsor.
The D3 Podcast is brought to you by Ketchikan Charter, the finest charter fishing company in Ketchikan, Alaska. If you want to be called a ho-ho-eating motherfucker by a big Alaskan man, go to ketchikancharter.com. You ever been told to pick up the cocksucker by a guy who wears exclusively Star Wars t-shirts? Go to ketchikancharter.com.
I'm going. I'm sold.
Oh, I love Bill.
Hey,
And that was a great message we just heard from our sponsor, and which I'm really looking forward to visiting one of these days.
Lovely, lovely Ketchikan.
Yeah.
Well, so on the break, Jeremy, you were talking about some stuff that we had to actually not talk about because we wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, you know, there's certain things you can't talk about, but maybe from the past, if there's any sort of marketing success stories, maybe not even products you've worked on, but things that stand out to you as being, wow, that was really successful and that was really clever. And I'm curious what sort of worked and what hasn't.
So the most recent example I can think of was a couple of years ago. For the longest time, I mean, 20 plus years, right? When you announce a game, it's usually like 12 or 18 months before it ever sees the light of day. Yeah. And then you stretch out this campaign forever.
Building buzz.
Trying to build buzz, but over 12 to 18 months, people just tune out, right? And then they pay attention at certain points. And a couple of years ago at E3, I guess it was right before E3, Fallout 4 was announced. But Bethesda did their big press conference, and here's Fallout 4. It's coming in November.
Everybody kind of expected this, right?
It's like their campaign literally went 6 months, which was mind-blowing. Like, nobody had done that yet. And now it's becoming kind of, you know, the campaign window is shortening because people have the eight-second attention span shorter than a goldfish. But then they also dropped this other massive bomb that says, oh, and we've got this other thing called Fallout Shelter, and it's this really cool mobile game, and guess what? You can download it now. Wow. And everybody went apeshit, and I'd never played a Fallout game before.
People flipped out.
Yeah. I'm watching this thing, and I go straight onto the App Store, and I download the thing, and I play it crazily, and then, you know, just like that was really well done.
Yeah.
And now it's almost... I guess you can credit Bethesda for doing this. They kind of shortened the marketing window. Like, just come out, make an impact, and then get your game out.
Right.
There's no reason to do this two-year-long thing because you're competing with movies and TV and other video games.
Right.
I guess I can say this example because it's public knowledge. But when Red Dead 2 was announced, all they did was slap red all over their social channels. And the internet went nuts.
Just ape shit.
They didn't have to announce that Red Dead was coming out. It was just, it's red. It's Rockstar shit.
It was just flat red. It was just a red block.
And then like 2 days later, they had their trailer or whatever. It's like there's, if you can create enough mystique and enough of a following around something and then just do something that's so simplistic, that's magic as a marketing guy.
Sure.
You don't have to work that hard for it. You just, hey, what if we paint our social channel red?
Right.
People know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's really cool. I mean, this E3 I'm looking forward to. There's bound to be a ridiculous amount of surprises that pop up that nobody knows what's coming. Who knows where it's going to come from? But I can't imagine that it's just going to be a boring E3 where everything that's expected comes out. Somebody's got to throw a curveball somewhere.
Yeah.
And be the news story.
I've seen a thing or two around I think there's going to be some good stuff coming out.
Oh, you got some inside information? Is that what you're saying?
No, I know no secrets.
Project Calamity?
Project Calamity. We use Calamity as our code word for any project we can't talk about.
Nice.
Thank you, Ben Jones. One thing I wanted to ask about, is there a Matt Knowles game in the future? Is there a game you would love to make or love to be a part of?
It's not my specialty.
I'm kind of the same way.
You know what I would love to do someday? And my brother and I have talked about this. I would love to market a game that my brother designed.
That'd be cool.
Because he and I, he's the brains behind the project. He knows how to make the thing fun. And he knows how to make something that people want. And my job is then to make people pay attention to it and ultimately go buy it. Like, that would be my dream scenario.
Man, that could have some serious repercussions if you fuck it up.
Yeah, I know. But I'm a marketing guy. I'm not a game designer. I'm not about to tell a game developer how to make their game. I'm just try to convince people to buy this really cool thing that somebody else developed. Like, that's that's my job.
Oh, so this is going to be totally out of left field, but I wanted you to tell the story. We were talking about it on the ride over here, but we had Morgan Godad on the podcast, and he was talking about Will Wright and his Playland
warehouse
that he had built in the warehouse with the remote control couch and all that sort of stuff. But you also have built an adult fun land in your backyard.
I do not have a remote control couch. I don't have a fucking gumball machine to the sky.
No, but yeah, tell Jeremy about what you built, because I think this is absolutely brilliant.
So I have to disclaimer this for everyone listening, because my wife and I just got, we live in the Bay Area where it's ridiculously expensive, right?
Where in the Bay Area?
In Marin County, okay. Which is ridiculously expensive.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And we got our first house in 2013. So it was right when the market was still down. And we begged, borrowed, and stole. We got enough money to make a down payment on a house. And the reality that I didn't know was if you can get to the down payment, which is the hardest part, the mortgage is actually cheaper than rent in the Bay Area.
So you're winning.
Awesome. So it's like, you know, you just want your foot in the ladder.
Yeah.
And you can start playing Monopoly. And then the market turned up. And then fast forward to 2015, we were like, this was a really, like, I'm not even going to bore you with the story, but the house that we got was ridiculous as a starter home, but it was the same price as all the really tiny houses as a starter home. So we're like, right, this is how we're going to start. 2 years later, the market goes up, the equity in the home goes up, Bay Area, everyone wants to live there. So everyone starts to outbid the next person, right? So we made a little money on our first house and got lucky. And both houses that we bought were off market, never competed with anybody. We just made the offer and we got in. The second house was the dream house. It was the dream scenario. It needed a lot of work, but we were able to get it. Our mortgage went up like $100. So we're like, okay, so we've got all this money. We don't have kids. We're not going anywhere unless somebody removes us from this place in a pine box. So let's put the money back into the house. We don't need to pay it down. Mm-hmm. We don't need to. We're still young. And so we decide we want to build or rebuild our backyard. So we had this 1970s pool with a 1970s hot tub and a 1970s deck that was peeling away from said pool.
Yeah.
And so we brought people in. We said, rip the deck away. We want a hardscape deck. And my wife had this vision of kind of Ibiza setup and white stucco everywhere, Santorini style.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm on board. You're the design person.
Go for it.
Go for it. You have my support. So she came up with the dream and hired a bunch of people to put it all together. And one of the dreams, which I was really not a fan of, was putting a slide in.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I'm looking at this thing going, God, we're going to bring people over. People are going to be drinking. People are going to go and it's an insurance nightmare waiting to happen. Right. Mm-hmm. And we said, let's do it. We're getting the pool resurfaced anyway. Just have them build it. So the guy comes over and he starts looking around. He's like, oh, it's great. You guys are building slide. Like, we love doing that stuff. How old are your kids? My wife and I look at each other like 40.
So you have a giant fucking water slide.
So we have a,
oh, it's a water slide.
We so have
it's
a, got- 29 foot long
Whoa,
slide.
I love
so we live on a hill, right?
Yeah.
So the hill needed to be landscaped and we're like, well, just climb the slide up the hill and we'll put some steps up. And yeah, so we have a massive water slide.
What do your neighbors think of this?
Our nearest neighbor is not that close.
That's great.
So, but there are two requirements. There was the slide and a bar. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So our first house, we bought off this couple in their 60s and the guy had built a quote unquote shed in the back, right? 12 by 15 shed. You open the doors and it's got like this old, I don't know, like Swedish Scandinavian style doors that pop open and a fucking bar table drops down.
That's so great.
And it was a bar inside. So our shed was our bar. And when we sold the house, we're like, oh man, I need a place for my kegerator.
My bar shed.
So we extended our retaining wall out into this dirt hill and then dug into the hill and then raised the retaining wall 12 feet high and built a open structure so we didn't have to really worry about getting planning permission because it's a giant retaining wall.
Yeah.
And then just plugged a bunch of stuff in and hey, there's our bar.
That's amazing.
So you have a bar and a giant water slide.
Yeah.
That is,
it took 9 months and we have a party pad. So,
we're kind of getting to the end of the time and as always, we'll head to the actual commercial bar after this. But, you know, one thing we like to do on the podcast is talk about what it takes to get into the industry and different positions. And, you know, I know a lot of people are trying to get into the design aspect of it right now, but anybody who's in marketing, what advice would you have for somebody who wants to get into marketing and video games? What does it take?
Well, my personal opinion is that you need to have a passion for games. Like, if you're going to earn the respect of the development team, which is kind of, if you're in brand marketing, you have to do that. If the developer thinks you're just some marketing guy.
We hate everybody.
I know.
So it is a challenge.
See, you have to have a passion for games. You have to be a gamer. But there are other companies out there that are just, you know, CPG people, and they bring them in and they're good at what they do, but not really on the actual game. So like, have a passion for games. Have a passion for learning, because stuff moves so quickly. I've only been in this industry 22 years, but things have changed. Like every 2 years, something new is popping up, something goes away. You know, Facebook is around now, but it might not be around in 5-10 years time. So you have to have your finger on the pulse of what's coming around. You have to know where people are going for their information. That's the key to get into marketing. And it helps to know people, because we, as you know, have a very small, incestuous industry.
Yes,
where
we do.
I work with about 12 people that I worked with at previous companies before.
Yeah.
That's so you want to find the good people that you know and can work with.
Do you think a traditional marketing degree helps in this, or is this something that people can take more
nowadays? No, I mean, look, when I started, people came up from QA and wound up in marketing. Now it's like you kind of need to have a degree and specialize in something and understand marketing analytics. And it all sounds like scary stuff, but you kind of have to know that now, because that's where the industry is going. We've moved away from just put a print ad down. It's like you have to know where people are. You have to have data to back up spending money, because we spend a lot of money. And the bosses up top are like, we spend a lot of money in this game. You're spending a lot of money on marketing. Show us how this is coming back to us.
Yep. Are there any resources out there that you know of that cater towards specifically marketing and video games? Are there?
I don't know if there are. If you have a general fundamental understanding of marketing principles, that's a win. Obviously, if you have a master's, it's even better. But if you have marketing analytics, you're even better set. Because everything now is performance-based. It's kind of like the mobile model of making games and marketing games and selling games has moved its way into the video game side of things, console and PC side. So if you understand all the boring acronyms and things like CTAs and conversion rates and all that stuff, like that's kind of critical now
CTA.
Coming in. CTA.
Click through. What does that mean? What's CTA?
You
just called me on it. CTR, there's click-through rate.
Okay, maybe that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, sorry. I got my acronyms messed up.
I'm sorry.
There's cost per click, CPC.
There you go. Okay.
CTR, click-through rates, yeah. Everybody throws that shit around.
When you've got a marketing budget for a project, is it are the slices of that pie for where you sort of spend that money the same generally for video games from game to game, or does it really, really totally depend on the game and the company?
Well, I can't speak for other companies, but there's generally buckets where money will go, right? If you have because the spectrum has become so broad now, you've got indie games that just sell on Steam, so you don't really have to worry about spending money at a retail channel to put POP up, and you know, you walk into the store, boom, it's right there. So generally speaking, big console PC development stuff, you got to spend money at retail so that when somebody goes into a mall or whatever, they know it's there. Or if they're going to Amazon or Walmart or GameStop.com, boom, it's there. They know. So there's a bucket of money. There's a general advertising budget. So whether that's if you're on Facebook and you see some ads pop up, or you go onto IGN and you see a big display ad, or you're on ESPN and some video plays, like
that's
there's
your
that.
Budget. Yep.
Yeah. Events.
Right.
So if your game is event worthy, you're going to have to build a big booth and bring a bunch of people there and showcase the game. There's that budget. Merchandise depends on the game, but people spend a lot of money on chotch. And you got to build the chotch and sell it. So there's that. So there's generally the same buckets across the board, but game to game, publisher to publisher, how much you put where is going to change a little bit.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're probably about out of time, and this is a weeknight podcast, and I know you have meetings in the morning, but hey, thanks for being on. And anybody who's listening to this, remember, even if you build a great game, you need a great marketing person behind it to hopefully get you some cash in your pocket. So ladies and gentlemen, keep an eye out for Matt Knowles, and
thank you, Ryan.
If you're an aspiring developer and you happen to see Matt in one of the shows, buy him a Yingling. It turns out this is his favorite beer, and maybe also some a bit of advice for everybody. So, Matt, thank you very much. We'll see you next next week. At
thank
E3,
you, guys. A lot
I'm
of fun.
Sure we'll be even drunker.
I hope so. Thanks, man. Yeah, it's going to be great.
Jeremy, take us out.
That's about it. Until next time, thanks for listening to the D3 Podcast.